Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Department of International Relations titled Going Global, Europe and the Third Pillar of Missile Defense. Speaking will be Tomáš Klavaňa, spokesman of the Czech Republic, on missile defense. We begin with an introduction by Professor Chandler Rosenberger. Dr. Rosenberger.
I am delighted to welcome you to this afternoon's lecture by Tomáš Klavaňa, spokesman of the Czech government for missile defense. Dr. Klavaňa will speak to us today about going global, Europe and the third pillar of missile defense. Those of us who grew up with the Cold War and who watched the demise of the Soviet Empire sometimes have a slightly mistaken view of relations between the West, especially NATO, and the countries of Central Europe. We remember the attempted putsch against Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev in 1991 and the strong push thereafter for membership for Central Europe's newborn democracies. Then it seemed as if NATO's ties to Central Europe were essentially a one-way street. NATO would secure the political freedoms of the former nations of the Warsaw Pact from the unpredictable whims of an unstable Russia. We would be wrong, some thought, pretty patronizingly, to expect too much in return. Of course, the world has changed dramatically since 1991. Russian politics are no longer as unpredictable. If anything, they're perhaps too predictable. The disquieting threat of unforeseen and rash belligerence now comes from the roiling nations of the Middle East. In the face of these new challenges, our friends in Central Europe have shown extraordinary commitment to the defense of liberty, theirs, but also, at great sacrifice, ours. The nations of Central Europe, it turns out, are delighted to be NATO members, not only for the security it offers them, but also for the chance it gives them to serve the alliance. Today, Czech soldiers are serving in NATO operations in Afghanistan and with coalition forces in Kosovo and Iraq. Some NATO countries are still refusing to commit troops to actively fighting the Taliban. But last week, Czech Prime Minister Mirek Topolánek announced that his nation will more than double their forces in the fight. Czech diplomats, politicians, and nonprofit groups have been just as dedicated to the spread of freedom. Cuban border guards at the Havana airport have learned to search the luggage of anyone carrying a Czech passport. Chances are good that they are smuggling in literature to boost the spirits and aid the operations of the extraordinary Vajela project, itself modeled on Czechoslovakia's movement for democracy. In June 2006, dissidents from Belarus, Burma, Cuba, Iran, and a myriad of other oppressed countries all met in Prague to share ideas about how they too might consign their own dictatorships to the dustbin of history. I hope you'll consider the words of our distinguished guest in this light. Dr. Klavaňa was an undergraduate in Prague when student protests ignited his country's revolution against communist rule. He quickly co-founded the country's first truly free newspaper, Studentski listy. As a popular broadcaster on student radio, he rallied his classmates to demonstrate in Wenceslas Square. Since then, Dr. Klavaňa has made the promotion of strong ties between the Czech Republic and the Western Alliance his life's work. After earning a PhD from the University of Minnesota, Dr. Klavaňa taught as a visiting professor at the University of Southern Maine. He returned to Prague in 2000 to become a senior international affairs commentator from Mladá fronta Dnes, then deputy editor-in-chief of Hospodářské noviny, a leading Czech daily. In 2003, he was a Shorestein Fellow at Harvard University, then served as press secretary and policy advisor for President of the Czech Republic. After countless appearances on television, Dr. Klavaňa is easily recognized on the streets of Prague as one of his country's most respected authorities on international relations. In the past few years, however, Dr. Klavaňa has earned another nickname, Mr. Radar. Don't be alarmed. Dr. Klavaňa has not acquired mysterious superpowers in some comic book-style scientific experiment gone wrong. The nickname refers instead to Dr. Klavaňa's many town hall meetings across the Czech Republic, where he tirelessly explains the contribution his country can make to global security. By accident of geography, The Czech Republic is the country best suited to host a battery of radar battery guiding rockets that could shoot down a ballistic missile launched from the Middle East. Knowing well his eloquence and his commitment to the transatlantic alliance, the Czech government turned to Dr. Kolvana to help persuade his fellow citizens to participate in this international project. Despite hostility from Russia, and even from some West European and American elites. Dr. Kolvana, in short, has shown the kind of dedication to liberty and its defense that was evident among Czech dissidents long before the fall of the Berlin Wall. If we had read the words of Czech dissident Václav Havel carefully, we would have seen the first intimations of this commitment, even at great risk, one that animated him and his finest fellow citizens. Writing in 1985 of his suspicions of mere disarmament, Havel called for Western peace activists to recognize that sacrifices must sometimes be made in freedom's name. The experience of totalitarian rule, Havel wrote, had endowed the Czechs with, quote, an inner radar capable of recognizing an approaching danger long before it becomes visible. Our guest today has shown that he is guided by a particularly Central European sense of obligation to liberty, so dearly won and now so passionately defended. It is therefore my great pleasure to welcome to Boston University Dr. Tomáš Kolvana to speak on the great challenges that he and his countrymen now take up on our behalf. Dr. Kolvana.
Thank you, Chandler, for this very nice introduction. I was looking in the room for a person he was talking about, and then I realized it was about myself, and so it's very hard not to blush. But thanks a lot for this opportunity. I always like coming back to this area, to New England, where I spent some months and possibly even a year, if you put it together. And I really like this because this is the closest to Europe you get in the United States. And after 8 years where I, you know, in which I became real American patriot, one of my kids carries American passport, I'm still a European. And I do not like that division between new and old Europe, as you may have heard from one of your former defense secretaries. Going global, Czech perspective on missile defense is the title of my talk. I'm going to be talking about missile defense, but I also would like to talk about values because this is really very important to the Czech government currently. Chandler mentioned that the Prime Minister of the Czech Republic, which is really the most important political position in the Czech political system. The Prime Minister runs the government. He visited President Bush and spent about 75 minutes in really working like talks about all kinds of issues, and all of them really related to the defense of values. About a year ago, almost exactly a year ago, the U.S. government asked the Czech government to consider stationing a part of the global or globalizing missile defense system on the Czech territory. That's the radar Chandler was alluding to. We still negotiate. We hope that we will be concluding these negotiations in months' time, and then the Czech Parliament will have to ratify whatever we will be able to finish in those talks. But generally, the Czech government doesn't shy away from proclaiming pretty loud and clear that under certain conditions, we really believe that the system, the global missile defense system, is necessary, and we do support it. You see the three reasons, or three general reasons, we decided to talk and communicate to our countrymen who are very suspicious. The system is very unpopular. And if you're interested in opinion polls, I can talk to you about those in the end of my talk. But basically, we believe that we have collective responsibility to protect our culture and civilization. We do have this responsibility to confirm the Atlantic bonds. We have become part of NATO in 1999, And we believe that this contributed to our current state in which the Czech Republic or the Czech lands in general are really secured, probably the best secured in its history. And NATO, of course, the collective defense of NATO, according to the Article 5 of the Washington Treaty, is the main part of that security. And we also believe that we live in a dangerous world, and therefore we want to be prepared. I can use this wonderful American saying, better safe than sorry. That's why we want to invest our minor part into this collective missile defense. Prime Minister, my boss, Prime Minister Topolánek, and President Bush talked about the radar, talked about missile defense, but not just about that. They spoke about Afghanistan, Iraq. Prime Minister met during his Washington trip not just with the administration official and Congress people, but also with dissidents from Burma, Belarus, Cuba, and Iran to reinforce our commitment to these people and in various countries. Czech government and also non-government organizations help the dissidents to undermine the totalitarian or authoritarian regimes there. So we see the defense of our territory via missile defense and also large part of Europe as a value exercise. It is also about our collective past. I mean the Czech collective past. We do not have a proud tradition of defending our country against external enemies with weapons. Many times in the past we were not really brave enough to stand against the invader or aggressor, but there are parts, there are strains in our history and in our tradition that we can be proud of. During the First World War, between 1914 and 1918, it was the Czechoslovak legions, Czechoslovak army in or abroad, which was fighting the Bolsheviks in the Soviet Russia, and they really laid the foundation to the modern Czech state in 1918, 1919, and later on. We do have a proud tradition of the anti-Nazi resistance during the Second World War. Some of you may be aware of the fact that the Czechs or the Czech patriots actually managed to assassinate Reinhard Heydrich in 1942, which was the highest-ranking Nazi official ever assassinated. We do have a proud tradition of anti-communist resistance starting right away in 1948 after the communist coup, although that part of our history is still a bit unknown because it's very uneasy. There's still Communist Party in the Czech parliament, and many people are of communist persuasion or are at least looking backwards to the communist regime with a benign eye. So that's why the Prime Minister met with a group of anti-communist resistors who actually managed in 1953 to shoot its way through East Germany to the West Berlin and then join the U.S. Army. They still remain very controversial in Czech Republic and in Czechoslovakia because of decades of communist propaganda portraying them as murderers. Prime Minister showed the courage to actually meet with one of the people and award him with his personal medal. So that's why I really want to emphasize that missile defense is not just about security, although it is of course about security. It is not just about politics, and I will talk about that later. It is about politics as well, but it's primarily about values. Then, of course, there are conditions under which we would agree to host the radar site. These negotiations continue, but I believe they will be successfully concluded fairly soon. Sometimes we hear protestations and criticism from Russia, and especially President Putin, or the former President Putin, that this is really about tipping off the strategic balance. This is about disturbing that strategic balance. We can use that radar site and 10 interceptor missiles in Poland to threaten Russia, which, of course, is not really based on or in reality. We all know, or at least those of us who really follow the issue, that there are different threats to us, to the Western alliance, and to free nations in Western Europe and North America today. The world has changed, and it has not changed on 9/11/2001. We only realized that the world has changed that day, but the world of 9/10 was exactly the same as the world 9/12/2001. There was nothing new on that day except, of course, of that horrible attack here on the American soil. But everything that contributed to that attack was well known to people who wanted to know before that in the 1990s. Most of us just did not pay enough attention to that. The world really changed between 1989 and 1991, when communism in Central and Eastern Europe and then in Russia disintegrated. You probably also know that during the Cold War, during the times when this strategic balance really existed, that's something that Putin alludes to and doesn't really exist anymore, in my opinion, that strategic balance between the two superpowers was really enabled by this very peculiar doctrine, very peculiar theory that you may have heard of. That's called mutual assured destruction, or MAD. Mutual assured destruction was very simple. You picture these two cowboys standing across the street in a Wild West town, and each holding pistols, revolvers, with nuclear weapons pointing at each other. And each of them really knows that if he starts shooting first, that would be the collective suicide for him and his part of town. So that cowboy really doesn't start shooting. That very firm rationality, which really applied to the Soviet Union and, of course, applied to the free world led by the United States, kept peace, the strategic peace, for at least 35 years of the ballistic age. Well, ballistic age really came later than in 1945 or 46. That really was the key reason why the United States or the Soviet Union did not start the nuclear war. That equation was even later codified in the anti-ballistic missile treaty of 1972, in which both superpowers committed to not defending themselves against ballistic missiles. They remained open, they remained vulnerable, because they knew that paradoxically this vulnerability was exactly what really defended them against a strategic attack. If I build a missile shield, I'm getting strategic advantage, and then the balance is really tipped. So that's what the ABM Treaty and Mutual Assured Destruction was all about. That doesn't really apply to our new situation, the post-1991 world, the post-Cold War world. We still do not have a good name to describe that situation, but we know that that situation is qualitatively quite different. What we are really faced with now is chiefly the threat of Islamic extremism, Islamic terrorism, and that is not really based on the same kind of rationality that brought about the mutual assured destruction psychology and doctrine. We are really afraid of ballistic missiles and nuclear technology coming into the hands of unstable regimes and even non-state actors. I'm talking about states like Iran, I'm talking about states like North Korea, but who knows what's going to happen in Pakistan tomorrow, let alone in 5 or 10 years' time. And Pakistan already possesses a nuclear bomb and is developing long-range ballistic missiles, as is Iran. But we may, as rational people, argue whether the Iranian regime under the Ayatollah and under President Ahmadinejad is rational or not. We may say perhaps they are rational. Perhaps the doctrine of mutual assured destruction, or at least deterrence, applies to Iran. Perhaps they are just cynics who use religion as a tool to stay in power. That's the better option for us. But perhaps they are not. You know, perhaps President Mahmadinejad is really capable of committing collective suicide in exchange of attacking some serious Western interests with nuclear weapons. We don't know that. We can argue about that, but that very uncertainty is already a big factor in our deliberations about how are we going to defend ourselves collectively in Europe and in the United States. But there is absolutely no argument about the nightmare scenario under which Al-Qaeda or similar groups acquire nuclear weapons and possibly in the future ballistic missiles. They do not have them today, and it is not easy to get and start operating ballistic missiles. But who knows? What if in 20, 25 years they attack a base where ballistic missiles are stationed and they manage to occupy that base for 1 or 2 days? That would be enough for them to fire 1 or 2 or 3 of these ballistic missiles to Europe, or if they will be intercontinental to the United States. And that's exactly why the United States and the allies decided to build this limited ballistic missile defense system. It's a system aimed at unstable regimes and non-state actors. It is a system which is capable of protecting us against few, limited number of ballistic missiles launched from the unstable regions. So it's definitely not something that Russia should be worrying about strategically. Putin's rhetoric about tipping off strategic balance is just that, I believe, political rhetoric that he and his generals use for domestic consumption. Missile defense, as is being deployed now, is not technically capable to protect against a massive Russian strike. Sometimes you also hear about the new arms race, which is supposedly being triggered by missile defense. Well, Russian Federation adds about 5 new ballistic missiles a year, and that's part of a general modernization of Russian armed forces. That's their ordinary capability. It's very different from the Cold War times, when they really added about 250 new missiles each year to their arsenal, on average, of course. In addition to these concerns that the United States, allies, and NATO are trying to dispel, these allies are regularly informing Russia through regular channels of communication, especially through the NATO-Russia Council based in Brussels within NATO, about its missile defense plans. And they are also inviting, and especially the United States is inviting Russia to participate in that missile defense system. So far, we have not heard any really positive response from Russia, but we have not heard, which is encouraging, a decisive no. They are playing with it politically, but they have not said no. The ideal situation would, of course, be if they agreed to participate, if they agreed to build the missile defense systems collectively. Unfortunately, Russia now uses targeted misinformation campaign, bullying, and selective interpretation of recent history to achieve its goals, and especially to influence citizens in Central and Eastern Europe, which is not all that hard because, as I said, any new defense capability, any new defense systems are bound to be unpopular among the populations, even in Central and Eastern Europe now, let alone, of course, Western Europe. Russia, and that's the last reason why I believe that that we hear so much Russian rhetoric about missile defense. Russia still considers Central and Eastern Europe as its sphere of influence, as its political backyard. This is the Yalta mentality, the mentality of the Cold War. But we have to be very clear about that. And I can tell you that I met with several American politicians who are very skeptical about missile defense as such, very critical. But they say, in the end, we support that precisely because of the Russian stance, because if we caved in today, it would look like they have a veto over our foreign and defense policies. I don't know whether that is a good reason, but that's a reason that's occasionally given to us. So what are the strategic dimensions of the radar site and the third pillar, as it is called? The third pillar, because the deployment into Europe would be sort of the third leg of the entire system and would protect Europe and the United States, which to some extent is already protected. The missile defense based in the Czech Republic and Poland would extend the protection to European allies. The radar for the Czech Republic and GBIs, or ground-based interceptor missiles, are exclusively defensive and contribute to a NATO collective defense according to the Article 5 of the Washington Treaty. When I say exclusively defensive, I mean that these interceptor missiles do be based in Poland, and some of those are already based in Alaska and in California, really cannot be easily converted into strategic missiles that would carry nuclear weapons. Imagine that a warhead carrying a nuclear weapon, a simple nuclear weapon, is about 500 kilogram of weight. The ground-based interceptor, which is aimed just to at destroying the incoming missile, is basically just a piece of steel, which is pretty sophisticated piece of steel. But it carries no offensive warhead. It carries no warhead as such, and it is about one tenth of that weight, about 65 kilo. So it doesn't really require a huge rocket, a huge missile. It's a relatively small piece of equipment. So the silo in Poland, which is about 10 GBIs, would be the size of a football field. And to convert that easily into an offensive capability, you can't really do it overnight. It would be visible from the satellite surveying systems. And, of course, the treaty negotiated with the Poles is strictly about defensive mechanisms. So occasionally the argument that goes along these lines, say, yes, that you can convert it easily and very quickly into an offensive system is not something that should be used, because that's simply not true. It is not easy to convert these into offensive systems. The third site, or the third pillar of this global missile defense system, will be interlinked and complemented with the NATO system against short and medium range ballistic missiles, which is sometimes also called theater defense. NATO calls it Alt-BMD. Don't force me to decrypt that. But it's basically a system that protects you against the short range and some medium range missiles. Whereas we are now talking about territorial defense against medium to intercontinental missiles. So the third side will definitely not disturb the strategic balance, and it might even dissuade some states from acquiring ballistic and nuclear technologies. It definitely at least raises the bar of overcoming that defense. So you need some sophistication to overcome. You need to invest into that, and therefore some nations will not have money and abandon that effort. That's at least the theory. Missile threat is real. If you just look at numbers and statistics, number of ballistic missiles goes up dramatically in the last 35, 40 years. In 1972, only 8 states possessed ballistic missiles, whereas in 2004, it was already 22 states. These missiles were used in 8 wars and conflicts, so it's not true that we don't have any experience with those carriers. We do. In 2004, you have, as I said, 22 states, and we are adding more and more. Many of these are former Soviet republics, and sometimes the argument goes, well, this is an artificial enhancement of the number of countries, because many of those countries really are part of the former Soviet Union. But that is not a good argument for myself, because the more governments, you know, the more uncertainty about security. And some of these governments are not all that stable. You look at them, and you look and you see it's not just Israel, it's not just the United States, it's not just Pakistan, which at this time is fairly secured, but it's also Egypt, it's Libya, Syria, Kazakhstan. All these countries are certainly of concern. You see some missile types. I've used that liberally, but for those of you who do not study the topic, there are several categories which are really determined by their range. So you have short-range ballistic missiles on the left with several hundreds to very few thousand or maybe roughly 1,000 kilometers of range. Then you have medium-range and intermediate-range ballistic missiles. And then you have intercontinental ballistic missiles capable of flying from one continent to another and causing great damage. Especially intermediate and medium range and intercontinental ballistic missiles are really aimed for carrying nuclear weapons. There is no other strategic reason for developing that range without really having them to carry nuclear weapons, because they're very expensive. How does the U.S. missile defense look like today? And what is deployed and what is not? Well, this is a simple table which tells you that we already have some defenses against the short-range ballistic missiles and medium-range ballistic missiles. Sometimes you read quite a lot in newspapers about the Patriot system, PAC-3, which is now deployed globally. It's a mobile system, and it is aimed at shooting down the missiles and rockets in the terminal phase. And it's a very, very reliable system. It has been improved over the last 15 years tremendously. It was used in 1991 during the first Gulf War with mixed results. But during 2003 Iraq War, during the war against Saddam, it was used 9 times, and 9 times out of 9 it succeeded. So it had 100% success rate. The U.S. territory is partially covered against the short-range and medium-range ballistic missiles. Against ICBMs, which are the most dangerous ones, there already is a radar in the United States, in the United Kingdom, and Japan. There are interceptor missiles in Fort Greely, Alaska, and the Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. And there are sea-based missiles and radars deployed already as a part of the system. In Europe, we have in Britain at this time the early warning radar in Fylingdales in the UK. And as I said, we have almost developed as part of NATO this theater missile defense with up to 1,800 miles range missiles or against those missiles. And now we are negotiating about stationing the ground-based interceptors in Poland and European-based radar in the Czech Republic. There also will have to be eventually stationed a so-called forward-based radar, which is a highly mobile radar, in East Turkey, Caucasus, or Caspian Sea region, which will be integral to that third European site. Here's another slide which basically explains very similar facts. You have radars in Alaska, in California and in the UK. These are, each of them has slightly different function for the system. You have ground-based silo interceptor interceptor missiles, 21 of them in Alaska currently and 3 in California, of course protecting chiefly against the North Korean threat. You have mobile forward-based radars, one sea-based off the coast of Alaska, 2 forward-based X-band radars to be deployed soon, and 7 Aegis-based surveillance and track untracked destroyers, which is of course the sea, which is the ship-based radars. And you have also mobile interceptor missiles based on the Aegis systems, the ships, other destroyers. And you have 21 standard missiles and 546 Patriot PAC-3 today. Since 1985, when the United States started investing into this, till last year, you have invested roughly $107 billion in the system. The budget of Missile Defense Agency, the Missile Defense Agency budget for this fiscal year is about $9 billion, so you may add to that. Here, this slide shows you development and deployment of ballistic missiles in these unstable regions between 2001 and 2007. You see that already in 2001, India deployed new intermediate-range ballistic missile, Agni-2, with the range of 3,500 kilometers, slightly less than 3,000 miles. Pakistan, during these 3 years, tested medium-range missile Shaheen-2 with a range of concern already. Iran tests medium-range ballistic missile called Shahab-3, but they also developed, according to their own data, a new missile which is propelled by solid fuel, which has a stronger and stronger push and therefore longer range, and that rocket, that missile, would be capable of reaching Europe today. So Iran is now already very likely capable of reaching Europe. Why do they do that? Why do they need these missiles if they say that they only want to be a regional power? They now have capability of reaching Europe. North Korea, very concerned. We are very concerned about the ICBM Taepodong 2, the range already with 6,000 kilometers. And there, of course, are non-state actors like Hezbollah, which, according to some data, acquired the short-range ballistic missiles Zelzal 2 with a range of about 200 kilometers. If you look at what Hezbollah owned 10 years ago, the development is certainly worrying. And I would not be as confident that Al-Qaeda is incapable of laying their hands on ballistic missiles within 15, 20 years if we still have Al-Qaeda. This map shows you what part is already deployed and what is protected and what is not yet protected. So the United States, Canada, Mexico, and Central America are already protected by the radars and interceptor missiles that are or are being deployed in the right now. If we add the third pillar in Europe, which would consist of the Polish missile or missile interceptors and the radar in the Czech Republic, plus the forward-based radar somewhere in Turkey or in Caucasus, we would dramatically enlarge the area that would be protected, and you see that in green. So that system would basically protect almost the entire European continent, with the exception of southeastern Europe, which would be vulnerable to attacks by short-range ballistic missiles. It's just too close to the unstable region. So there, of course, the NATO system would have to complement this territorial system. This is how the entire system looks like. If you look at the trajectory of a missile launched, it first goes through so-called boost phase. It is very hard technologically, even today with our technology, to shoot it down in the boost phase, chiefly because it's just too early, right? But we now have the systems in space that are tracking and surveying unstable regions, cameras and other sensors, and that's the system which actually spots the launch the first, right? It's not about radars on the ground or on ships. It's about radars or sensors in space on satellites. These really are the eyes of the system. They spot the launch first. They immediately transfer that information. You have that up there, these sensors. They transfer that information to the radars on the ground or on the sea, depending on where the missile is launched. And of course, a very frantic but completely automatic process of computing the trajectory of that missile starts. You need exact information about the trajectory of that incoming missile. That's really the important. That's the data you need to get as soon as possible. If a missile is launched in Iran, it can reach Central Europe in about 14, 15, 16 minutes. If it is launched against the United States from Iran, it can reach the United States in roughly 30 minutes. So you don't have much time. You need precise data as soon as possible. That's why you have the sensors on satellites and you have the radars. Then when the trajectory is computed, it is then given or relayed to the central command system. The interceptor 1, 2, or 3 are launched, and the radar, based in the Czech Republic, for example, would be very helpful in navigating or guiding that interceptor against the incoming missile. The best phase in which to shoot down the incoming missile is so-called mid-course phase, when the ballistic missile leaves the atmosphere and is in the stratosphere or space. That's the longest in terms of time, the longest phase of its flight. And that's where the interceptors that are, for example, based in Alaska or in California or possibly would be based in Poland, these interceptors would be used against the mid-course in space or in stratosphere. That's where the missile is engaged. Then, in the last phase, so-called terminal phase, if you are not able to shoot it down in the space, there are some weapon systems that are capable of destroying the incoming missile in the last phase. But it is still very hard technologically, and especially the ICBM is nearly impossible to destroy at this time with conventional methods. We will have very likely systems that will be able or are capable of shooting down the incoming missile in the third phase, in the terminal phase. But if you're talking about the ICBMs or the intercontinental missiles, it's still very demanding. But we have so-called terminal high-altitude defense systems that are mobile and are capable of shooting these missiles. We have, of course, Patriots against short-range ballistic missiles. And there are some Aegis-based missiles that are also capable of shooting down missiles in the third terminal phase. There is a laser weapon being developed for the 747 jumbo jet, which eventually will be capable of shooting down a missile in its boost phase. And there are other systems capable of destroying multiple warheads, because you may know that some of these missiles would be equipped with multiple warheads. There's this system that is now being developed and will be tested in a few years' time. And this multiple killing vehicle would be capable of shooting down several incoming warheads. And the radar, for example, the one in the Czech Republic, would be even capable of distinguishing between real warheads and decoys, so that the interceptor would not be wasted on a decoy and would really attack and shoot down the incoming warhead. That system is not in place yet. It's being tested, but you're fairly optimistic that this will be operational in a few years' time. Well, let me finish here, and if you have any questions, I'll be more than happy to answer these.
You mentioned about values, and that's key to this agreement. What are the values that you see the Czechs sharing with us in the United States? And in all likelihood, the implementation of this defense will happen in the next administration for us coming up here in less than a year. What does a new president, regardless of its political affiliation here, have to do to signal a sharing of those values that we do share?
Well, the most important values that we have in common are those we have already mentioned: our commitment to freedom and human rights in the world, which sometimes are not popular, sometimes not very fashionable, especially in some, you know, American and Western European universities. But we still believe in those values because we do remember communism, and I remember what it was like to grow up under a communist regime in the 70s and 80s. So certainly defense of freedom, help, assistance to freedom fighters. I'm talking about real freedom fighters, people who want democracy, who are defending those values, going to prison, fighting nasty regimes in Burma or Iran or in Belarus. We hope and believe that, and you're talking about the change in the White House. We believe that there will be no change on that, be it, you know, the Obama administration or the Clinton administration or the McCain administration. We have, of course, spoken to various congressmen and senators about this, especially from the Democratic side. Since last summer, I visited Washington several times, and I always make sure that I speak especially to the Democrats. In terms of what signals would the new government need to say, basically just continue working with us on Cuba. Talking to us before they change any policy in Cuba would be great if we get some, because we do have some programs in Cuba. Some of them we don't want to talk about openly, but we do. So any administration change, you know, we would greatly appreciate if the new administration consults with us on Cuba or some other countries, of course, like Burma or Belarus.
One of the things that's talked about a lot is Russian opposition to the Missile Defense Shield. And during your presentation, you mentioned that you thought there might be a way to eventually overcome this obstacle, to somehow perhaps bring Russia into the shield somehow. How might that happen? What do you see? Is it going to require a political change in Moscow, or is it going to have to require some kind of technological cooperation? You mentioned the need for this mobile radar site, perhaps in eastern Turkey or the Caucasus. Is this a potential area where Russia and the United States could cooperate?
Well, let me start from the back. Yes, that would be wonderful. In fact, they're not just saying no, all right? They most of the time they say no when the United States and the allies suggest that they should participate. But sometimes they offer a way of cooperation. For example, a few months ago, they offered a radar site in Azerbaijan, owned by Russia, which is a first step ahead. It was the first time when they actually didn't say no. They said, "All right, you can do it here in Azerbaijan, but it's either or. It's either here in Azerbaijan, but not in Poland and the Czech Republic, or we're not cooperating here in Azerbaijan," which is a no-go for strategic and geographic reasons, because that site would not protect Europe the same way as the pillar stationed in Central and Eastern Europe, just for the geographic reasons. Simple as that. But if we manage to agree with Russia eventually that the forward-based radar would be based in Azerbaijan, which would be an ideal place for a forward-based radar, that would be wonderful. That would be the first real step ahead. And then you could speak of a three-tier system. You could speak of the U.S. system, you could speak of the NATO system, and then you could speak of the Russian system, and they can cooperate in many ways. The only obstacle, of course, is political will. I think Putin plays that very skillfully because he now sees that it really enhances Russia's stature. He's, after all, getting all these lobster summits in Kennebunkport about missile defense, and he probably sees them as being analogous to the meetings between Gorbachev and Reagan in the 1980s. And that's what he wants. He wants to be seen as a superpower leader. He wants to enhance the Russian status. So I think he will milk that few more years, possibly, or maybe his successor will milk that because it's still pretty cheap and they are still scoring points. And there will come a time at which they will calculate that they're no longer scoring political points and they will have to make a decision. Do we really want to cooperate, or are we going to be confrontational? And I don't know what the outcome of that deliberation will be, but that deliberation is still few months or years ahead, depending on how they calculate that cost benefit analysis. Does it make sense?
Thanks very much for coming.
This is WBUR. You've been listening to a lecture presented by the Department of International Relations titled Going Global, Europe and the Third Pillar of Missile Defense. Speaking was Tomáš Klavania, spokesman of the Czech Republic on missile defense. Dr. Klavania was introduced by Professor Chandler Rosenberger from the Department of International Relations. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Michael Garth and Mike Toda with help from Jared Mooney. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.